Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to It's Rainmaking Time. This is Kim Greenhouse. There is a national bestseller called Ship of Gold in the Deep Blue Sea, written by Gary Kinder. And I had heard about Ship of Gold for quite a while, about this 1857 disaster where the SS Central America went down and was lost. Actually before the Titanic in 1912. And there was a young, I think 34-year-old engineer named Tommy Thompson in 1986 who raised $1.4 million to focus on locating and bringing up the SS Central America, which had huge amounts of gold on it. One of the reasons I thought it would be worthy of doing a show on this topic is not just the allure of treasure hunting, but the whole complex part of somebody who asks a lot of questions, has a desire to solve problems, and begins to put together thousands of people, 150 scientists, historians, and scholars, raises $12 million, and takes technology to the next level to find this ship of gold. Ladies and gentlemen, Gary Kinder is going to talk to us about that treasure ship, the actual adventure with Tommy Thompson, and what ended up happening with the ship, the gold, Tommy Thompson, and the complexity of this marine adventure. Ladies and gentlemen, Gary Kinder, welcome to It's Rainmaking Time.
Hi, Kim.
Thank you so much for being here. What a hugely complex, adventurous book that has so many different facets to it, from entrepreneurship to science to new technology to raising money, funding, and difficulty when you're doing new ventures. Talk about this ship of gold. Talk about the Columbia American Discovery Group and the SS Central America that was lost. Let's talk about the ship first.
Well, it was the greatest loss of life at sea in peacetime in American history. There were over 500 people died, 500 men. The Titanic, of course, was British. American warships were sunk in World War II that had more people on board. But that was the biggest at peacetime disaster. It was a huge hurricane. This is something I love about writing nonfiction, is that you learn so much. You think you know a little bit about, for instance, the California Gold Rush, but I learned that I knew very little about it. And I didn't know that actually prior to the California Gold Rush, the government was realizing that there was an area way west of the United States called California, owned by Mexico, that we started to have a little interest in, and there was a war going on in 1847, 1848 with Mexico, and that we might end up acquiring that, and we were going to need to provide mail service. So some enterprising people, entrepreneurs themselves back then, went to the government and said, we will build these ships if you will help subsidize it, and we will run them and carry the U.S. mails back and forth. And the government agreed to do that as long as these ships could be converted to wartime vessels if necessary. So they were, the original architecture designed them to add cannons to them and things like that. But they were, at a time, it was a very short period, a very short window, but it was a time in history in marine architecture where we were between a sail and having steam powered. And so these ships were very large. They were approximately 300 feet on average. And they had full sail, but they also had these gigantic steam engines, you know, run by coal. And they would run from New York down to Panama. The people would cross over the isthmus, pick up the Pacific steamer on the west coast, and take that up to San Francisco. And these ships ran just like an airplane. They ran every 2 weeks, just down and back, regular schedule. And this ship, the Central America, had picked up its passengers in Aspinwall, Panama, and ventured 4 days up to Havana, and then stayed overnight in the Havana Harbor, and then lit out for New York. They had about 5 days left, and there were 500 passengers on board and about 100 crew. Out of the passengers, there were about 30 women and about 30 children. The rest were all men, mostly miners coming back, some business people coming back from the gold rush. These ships, besides carrying the U.S. mail, they carried a lot of gold. I think the Central America had something approximating $1.7 million in gold. That was the value at the time at $20 an ounce.
Wow. What people would do to have $20 an ounce now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Wish you had bought it back then. Your great-grandfather had. Yeah, this was on average. They would carry $1.5 to $2 million in gold on these ships, and they were all marked. It's fascinating learning how they actually marked the gold and how they melted it down as it came in out of the Sierra Nevada, and created bars and established commerce by creating coins in small bars, and the bars were stamped and labeled and weighed and processed, and they were determined to be a certain fine. That's the percentage of gold in that bar. Very scientific back then, and very accurate by assayers in San Francisco. And then they would load these on the ships, and then they would carry them across the isthmus, and eventually had a little train going across the isthmus and loaded up on the other ship. And so the Central America was carrying a lot of gold on it, and it hit a hurricane. Weather started getting kind of bad the first evening out, and then it was much worse the next day, and then it got really bad, and they were in the hurricane. In fact, the eye of the hurricane passed over them while they were in what's called the Atlantic Bight, which is that curvature that occurs along Georgia and the Carolinas. So the ship went down, and they battled the sinking for several days, and ultimately they succumbed, but got the women and children off at the height of the hurricane into lifeboats, and there was a battered ship nearby, and they were able to rescue the women and children. You would think they would take them to shore, but they were 200 miles out, which I'd been out there while they were recovering the gold and doing some of their scientific experiments, and that is, it's no man's land out there. 200 miles is way, way offshore. And so the only thing they could do was try to get the women and children off at the last minute, and it was an act of mercy from somewhere that put this ship in that same channel within sight of the Central American. They got the women and children off. Eventually, some of the men survived it as well.
What a sad fall. I mean, that's a lot of loss of life.
Well, they were. It is. It was a huge. It was such a tragedy on so many different levels. The human loss was. You can imagine a lot of these men on board had families, and back in Pennsylvania and Ohio and New York, Boston, and they hadn't seen these families. Some of them for 3, 4, 5, 6 years. They had gone west as 49ers, and most of them did not make anything. They barely made enough to stay alive out there. It was very expensive out there and hugely competitive. And, some of these people, of course, had been farmers and ranchers, and they were tough. They were strong and strong-willed, and they discovered it was the hardest work they had ever done. Emotionally, it was tough, too. They were out there alone. They would meet other people out there, of course. They were mostly other men that they could befriend. But it was tough, and so here they were returning home, and they were going to see their families, and within a few days, after several years, some of them had kids who were 5, 6, 7 years old they hadn't even met yet, and to have all those lives lost, it was quite a tragedy. Especially the heroism involved. I haven't even mentioned the biggest hero in the story, which is who was the captain, Captain William Herndon. He was the first, we thought at one time, he was the first outsider to explore the entire length of the Amazon Valley, Amazon River. But there apparently was an English explorer who preceded him, I think, by 10 or 15 years. But he led the American expedition down. He was quite a hero, and he had written a book about it. He actually wrote it for Congress because he did it for Congress. And he was keeping tabs on all of the vegetation along the way, and the depth, the water, and the elevations, and the crops that were grown, and the peoples and the customs in the area, and reported back to Congress because they wanted to know what was there. And he was such a beautiful writer, and what he wrote was so lyrical and imaginative. People couldn't believe some of the things that he actually viewed with his own eyes. And so this report got out, and it became a big bestseller internationally. And so he was quite well known.
Do you know the name of the book?
It was called Exploration of the Valley of the Amazon, 1853 to 1854. I think those dates are right. It was something like that. My publisher, after the book was published, my book, Ship of Gold, bought that for me. They actually found a copy of it, an old original copy that was submitted to Congress. It's a beautiful book with hand-drawn maps and illustrations that were all pencil, graphite. It's a beautiful piece, and his writing is beautiful. That this is something I've always said, that little boys, when a little boy is born, his first thought is, how am I going to react in the foxhole? And I think little boys grow up that way. It's what would I do? I've been watching this latest series, Pacific, and I watched Band of Brothers not too long ago. It's been out for a long time, but I just saw it fairly recently. And you wonder, my dad was in World War II, but you wonder, how would you react in a situation like that? And this guy has 600 lives in his hands, and he knows, because he can use all of his celestial navigation equipment. Even in this storm, he was able to figure out roughly that he was 200 miles offshore, and he's got all these lives in his hand, and he knows that he's going to die. He was a deeply religious man, and he knows he's going to die, but he's got all these other lives, and he's got to keep them buoyed as long as he can. And because he does that, and because all of these miners, and I realize that if we've got 30 women and 30 children on board, that means that out of the 500 passengers, not very many of them are husbands and fathers, at least with people on board. So these were miners who bailed. They started leaking during the hurricane. They would have been able to weather the hurricane, but they sprung a leak. And as water was coming into the hold, they just formed bucket brigades, and they bailed for 30 hours. Now, standing in line...
What do you mean by they bailed for 30 hours? What does that mean?
They bailed water out of the hold, down where the coal was stored and the engines had gone out because the water had leaked in and put them out.
Got it.
But they just had buckets, any buckets, tubs, pitchers from the rooms up above the berths. They were getting the water out, and they had about four gangways, and they would just pass them up the stairs and dump it overboard. And these, the buckets were, they probably weighed 15, 20 pounds, and they're passing these from one hand to the next guy.
What an exhausting process.
Well, for 30 hours, and you have to realize they were all sick. They were all seasick. And they hadn't slept in two nights, literally had not had a wink of sleep. They had nothing to eat for 2 days because nobody could eat. And then for that effort, they were saving the women and children. They didn't have any loved ones, if you will, on board. So they were just doing the right thing. It is, it's honestly one of America's finest hours.
How did you get involved in the story? What brought you into the story, doing the research on it, and putting the book together?
Like so many things in life, Kim, I didn't mean to do it. It was kind of an accident. I had published two books, and I was looking for a topic for my third book, and I wanted to, I'd read an article about Tom Wolfe, who was one of my heroes. If I could say one person was a huge influence on my writing career and style and interest in writing, it would be Tom Wolfe. And this article, the interviewer asking, where do you go looking for such great stories? And they were talking mainly about the right stuff, about the astronauts. The original astronauts go into space, and he said, I never look for a great story. He said, I look for an interesting topic. And in researching that topic, I discover a great story. And he said that his research for The Right Stuff started out as an interest in rockets and Wernher von Braun and the Germans who came over and how they developed rocketry here. But then as he got further into it, he realized that the real story was with the men who put their hides on top of those rockets and got blasted out into space for the first time. And that's how he wrote The Right Stuff. So I started thinking about what would make an interesting story, something that I would enjoy working on, and also something that had some physical involvement in it, because as a storyteller, when you're writing nonfiction, you have to get your facts straight. All the stuff that's going on now about people making stuff up and it doesn't make any difference and it was sort of like this, that doesn't fly. That is not nonfiction. That is fiction. But if you're going to write real narrative nonfiction, you got to do all the research. You got to find out what really did happen. You got to talk to the people who were there. You got to read all the accounts. You got to go there yourself, see what it was like, what it felt like, what it looked like, sounded like, and then you put all that together in a story form. But to drive a narrative, it really helps if you have some physical involvement in it. And I had gotten certified as a scuba diver, gosh, a long, long time earlier when I was in school in Florida. And I started working on Ship of Gold, I was living in Idaho. There's not a lot of opportunity for scuba diving there, but I started thinking about scuba diving and what could I do with scuba diving for a story. And there were two obvious answers. One is treasure hunting, and the other is underwater archaeology. And I started looking into, at the time, this would have been in early 87, Mel Fisher had found the Atocha off Key West after something like 18 years of searching for it. And I thought, well, I'd be interested in doing a story about him, maybe, and there would be physical involvement in that, and that would be interesting, his 18-year search for the Atocha. And I read an article on him, and I called the author and talked to her about the possibility of my doing a book on him, and she advised me not to do it because it was, she said that a lot of these kids are on drugs, and Mel's kind of a nice guy, but he'll tell you one thing one day and totally the opposite the next day, or it'll be worth twice as much a week later. And she said there's another story that you might be interested in, and it's about this American ship that sank off the Carolina coast in 1857. And I remember thinking at the time that's not that interesting. That was not that sexy a story. Boy, was I wrong. and I was thinking in terms of the Spanish, you know, Main and the galleons and the jars of rubies and emeralds and religious reliquaries and things like that. So I started looking into this story, and I flew east to meet with the guy that she had interviewed, who said he was going to go out that summer on an expedition to find the Central American. I thought, well, that's close to scuba diving, to going out in this expedition, so I could see if I could get myself ensconced with this group. And he was a very nice man, but he just didn't have the wherewithal to go out. He didn't have the money. He really didn't. He knew a lot about how the ship sank, but he didn't know anything beyond that. But when I was talking to him one day, we were in this little waterside tavern in Charleston, and he said, I thought you might like to see this, and he reached into his wallet, and he pulled out this old yellow piece of paper, although it wasn't that old, really, it was just newspaper, and he unfolded it, and it was a recent article about a group that had filed an admiralty claim on a sidewheel steamer that sank off the Carolina coast in the mid-19th century. Well, anybody who knew the story of the Central America knew that had to be the Central America. And so I just got a name. I just saw a name there. One of the lawyers representing the group was named Bill Kelly. And I went back to my motel immediately, and I called Ohio, Columbus, Ohio, and talked. I got Bill Kelly at his house, and I think he was having friends over for a barbecue. Bill and I got to be good friends before this whole thing was over, but he said, I'll be happy to talk to you. Call me at the office on Monday. Here's my number. And so I talked to him, and he introduced me over the phone later to a guy named Rick Robel, who was this young lawyer out of Harvard who was in Norfolk, Virginia. And he's the one. One of the big leaps they had was that a federal court does not have jurisdiction over anything beyond 3 miles past the low water tide. This was out 200 miles, but in law school, Rick had written a thesis on the need for federal courts to take their jurisdiction farther out to sea, because someday before too long, there's going to be technology that could take us out that far. And there are going to be disputes over oil and mineral and minerals and fisheries and that sort of thing. And so he was the perfect candidate for this. Plus, he'd been a clerk with one of the federal judges in that same court, and so he was a good one to go to. And Rick ended up, I talked to him a few times, and he called me one day. I'm getting long story here, getting around to answer your question, Kim, but he called me one day and he said, you know, Tommy, who was the one who found the Central America, which is the rest of the story, is coming in a few days. You know, would you like to meet him? And I said, yeah, I'd love to. And so this was in, would have been in, I guess, July, probably mid-July of 87. And they were coming in for a big hearing because somebody was trying to drive Tommy off the site, literally push him with their ship off the site. And it was, I didn't know what was going on out there at the time, but later it was very dramatic, whole 1987 period when they were at sea. But Tommy came in. He was with Barry Schatz, who was one of his childhood friends who was helping him with this and was a big asset and trying to find the Central America. And I met Tommy there and talked to Barry for a good while I was there. Tommy was in the courtroom, and that was closed to everybody but the parties. And so I met Barry and talked to him for quite a while, met Tommy. And Tommy said at the time, which confused me, that I don't, you know, we really don't have time right now to accommodate a writer. Which I didn't understand. You know, we don't eat much. We just kind of stand around and ask some questions. But I found out later what he was going through, and he was about to lose his entire project after spending a large percentage of his life on it, because so many people were coming out there and trying to drive him off the site and challenging him and in court and this kind of stuff. So I just continued to stay in touch. I did some of my own research. I wrote a few letters to some people back in Columbus that were with Tommy's group, the Columbus America Discovery Group. And then the next fall, I got a call from Tommy and Barry, I think, and they said, we're ready to talk to you now. And I didn't know why they now were ready to talk to me, but I discovered later they had found the ship, and so they felt more comfortable with it, and the court had ruled that it would belong to them. And they were keeping all this very, very secret at that time. And so my editor and I flew to D.C. and met Tommy and Barry and Bob. Bob was the third in the group, who was extremely helpful in finding the Central America, another very interesting character. And the five of us really hit it off. I was a little older than the rest of them, but we were roughly the same ages and very enthusiastic. And they had a great story, and I thought I could tell it. And I had a great editor who was very supportive at what's now called Grove Atlantic in New York. And so that's how I got into it. And then right after that meeting, this would have been January of 89, I guess, then I started making frequent trips to Columbus. And that summer and fall, went out on the ship a couple times.
What do you think turned the preoccupation with Tommy Thompson for exploration and discovery? What transitioned the interest into him raising first $1.4 million and $12 million and then developing new technology to go down and find the ship? I mean, he had to develop new technology to make this happen. That's a lot. This is what fascinated me about this whole project, is that the intent was to be able to locate this ship, but then he realized he needed all these other tools and technologies to facilitate it, otherwise it would never happen. So an entrepreneur or an inventor can start out to try to accomplish A, but in order to get A done, you find out you have to get all these other things done to accomplish that along the way. So all these other things get born, and this is one of the most exciting parts of it. Now, I know it's more complex, because even after the ship was pulled up, how much gold was on that ship?
There were you have to divide it into three different groups of treasure. There was the consigned commercial shipment. That was recorded, and it was approximately 3 tons of gold. There are estimates that there was as much gold on, in purses and carpet bags and money belts carried by the miners themselves. So that would have been 6 tons. And then there's always been I think from what I know of talking to people who were involved in this project, although they never brought any of it up, they never found it. But I think that there was another 15 tons of gold that was an Army shipment. It was being transported by the U.S. Army. And at this time, I was saying there were a lot of reasons this was a tragedy. The people, obviously, but our economy at the time was very weak. The Crimean War had been going on for a few years, and all the farmlands in Central Europe, I guess, there were unproductive, and so they were buying wheat from the United States, and the only way they could get the wheat to the East Coast to ship it over was to put it on the railroads, and the banks financed the railroads. Well, when the war was over, there was no need for the wheat, so the railroads weren't necessary, and the banks were losing, and banks were folding, and it was a big, problem with our economy. They called it the Great, recession, something or other, of 1856, 57, 58. And so this gold was expected back east to help shore up the banks. And when that didn't arrive, that also, some people think that that led to, that was the final straw that caused the banks to collapse, and that led to the Civil War, because the North was perceived as being weak, and the Southern economy was strong, and that's when they decided to secede, and that this was a fairly big factor in that. Did I answer your question? I sometimes can get talked.
No, that's okay. Let me ask you another thing. There's a online magazine called Outside Online, and you wrote an article called The Billion Dollar Boat. Was it a billion dollar boat?
Didn't write that.
Well, they did.
Yeah.
It says, in June 1998, Outside Magazine's called The Billion Dollar Boat. Now, maybe they named it. It says by Gary Kinder. See, people could write things and use your name.
Well, how about that?
Well,
98. Well, the book came out in May of 1998, so was it a book review?
It looks like it. It looks like an article by you. They say by Gary Kinder.
Well,
something to check into.
Yeah, no kidding. I haven't been paid for that one.
All right, well, let's go back to Tommy Thompson. I totally understand why a venture like this would need to be under the radar to get it done and to only involve people that were going to be part of and integral to its accomplishment. I get that. And I totally understand the fallout of parasites coming from the outside who didn't do anything to try to claim the discovery. And this is not necessarily in your book, but there is complications after it's all said and done. Tommy Thompson has seemingly disappeared. Nobody can reach him, talk to him, etc. Christie's had a very difficult and unhappy experience with him financially and others. What happened to the original investors? Do you know?
What happened? Well, there were a bunch of them, and it kind of grew because they invested in 1985. So Tommy ended up going out just to do the search in 1986. That's the what they call mow the lawn. That's just going back and forth with this brand new prototype sonar. But the investors, there were several dozen of them, and then some of those had kids, and they put some of their investment in the Central America project. They gave them to four kids, and pretty before you knew it, they had 150 to 200 investors, I think, in this. You can figure that's 25 years ago. They invested. Some of them were in their 60s and 70s at that time.
Right.
So many of them have died.
Did these investors get paid back, whatever happened with Christie's and the other people? Because it is a major effort for somebody to have done what he did. Bringing all the people together, locating the ship, developing technology to go find it, bringing it up. Awesome. No question about it. And I'm sure there's a whole other entrepreneur element to this that's riveting. The other side of it is that there seems to be a lot of bitterness and bad blood on the business financial side at the end of this, having nothing to do with the parasites that tried to claim his discovery.
Right.
What happened? What can you speak to comfortably about why it ended up bitter for many of the investors and people that got involved with him on the business side? I don't want to dwell on it, but I'd like to know for the public.
Sure. No, that's a legitimate question, Cam. I'll tell you everything I know about it, which is not a lot. I've had a lot of people tell me on the inside of this, people from Christie's and other people, that this is at least as an exciting book as the one you've already written. All of the personalities and the conflicts and behind the scenes and all this stuff in the lawsuits. He's been sued over 200 times by all kinds of people just coming out of the woodwork claiming various things. You know, most of that's just frivolous stuff. But getting back to the investors, I know three things for sure. I know that they brought up a lot of gold. I've held it in my hands. I've seen pictures of the rest of it. I've talked to the people who at the coin dealers and numismatists who were selling the gold on the market. A lot of people have bought it. So I know one thing, that they brought up a lot of gold. How much it's worth, $100 million, $150, $200 million. I really don't know the total value of that gold, but they sold it, and I know that they got, for the biggest brick that was over 80 pounds of gold bar, they received about $8 million just for that one. And they had a lot of bars, and they had thousands of coins that were, you know, in a grade up in the mid-60s, and 70 is perfect. These were really valuable coins. So we know they recovered a lot of treasure. I also know that the investors never saw a dime of that. Number three, I know that Tommy would never abscond with money. He would never take some of that or put it into some Swiss account somewhere. So those three things, Tommy would never do anything with that gold that was less than above board. There was a lot of gold found. The investors have received nothing. I can't explain.
It's an anomaly that, you know, on one hand you can say, it's nobody's business except the people that were involved. And there's a lot of this that's sealed in the courts. But just between us and the public, it doesn't make sense how that magnitude of discovery could come up and the investors not get their investments back. That does not sit well with me. You know, I'm not here to judge him or what happened. There's a lot to learn from what he produced and created on so many aspects of this. But there was enough in gold discovered to have satisfied the investors. And that's going to be between him and God, whatever happened. And for whatever reason, you seem to know him well enough to know that he would never abscond with anything. But there is an anomaly with why the original investors weren't satisfied.
Well, I can tell you a little bit about numbers there. I know that when Tommy... about the time Ship of Gold came out in 98, somewhere along in there, that would have been even later than that, actually. Sometime in the early 2000s, I guess, Tommy sold the right, and when I say Tommy, his whole group sold the right to market the treasure for $50 million. Now, that did not mean they sold the treasure. They sold the right to market it to a consortium in Southern California.
Are you talking about the Columbia America Discovery Group licensed it?
In effect.
In effect. Allowed it to be marketed, like to a Monex or something like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was to an investment consortium in Southern California, gave Tommy $50 million, gave Columbus America Discovery Group $50 million. And that gave them the right to sell the gold. And they distributed the gold among three big international coin dealers. And then they packaged things. They would package two small bars or three coins and a bar, and they put them in lots. And they sold them, and again, I don't know how much they raised totally. Now, the way I understand what happened, and I don't know much about this, I don't know any of the real details of it, two things. One is, once they had reached that $50 million figure, then the Columbus America Discovery Group would share in everything that was realized after that.
Not the $50 million? In other words, their $12 million wouldn't have been returned to them, leaving the balance for whatever?
Well, they would have gotten the second group, the second consortium in Southern California would have gotten their $50 million back plus another profit, and it wouldn't be anything above the $50. It'd be anything above whatever that extra bit was plus the $50. They would begin to share in that. Now, I would think that they sold everything, and I don't know. I think every once in a while people say, well, I just saw your gold on, as it belongs to me, your gold on TV, and it's still for sale. And out of those resales, or if it's still the original, they haven't sold all of it. It's conceivable that they just haven't finished selling enough of it to realize that contract. Now,
well, if it was Monex, they leverage metals. They don't actually own anything. So if it was them,
I don't know what Monex is.
Well, nobody really does.
Is it money exchange or something? Or
they are in the business of selling metals, but they sell metals contracts and they leverage metals through ETFs.
Now,
and
this would be historical collector's items. You know, these bars and the coins were extremely valuable, not even for their numismatic value, but for their provenance. The story of where they came from and going to the bottom of the ocean and being brought up from there and all that stuff, that's what gave them their real value. But there was a group called Monaco Financial, who was the chief of the three, who were largely involved in selling the gold to the public. But let me go back to the $50 million figure. At the time they made that deal, Columbus America was in debt $43 million.
From lawsuits?
it was fighting lawsuits. It was a variety. It was going back out because they announced, they actually found the gold in 88, but they announced it publicly in 89. And they went back out on in the ocean in 90 and 91 and maybe 92. Doing scientific experiments and cleaning up stuff where they had, found the gold in that area. This is a 10-acre site. That's, you know, that's, and it's dark, it's black, and it's hard to work in, and so it's very tedious work. But they went back out. That cost money. A lot of things cost money, and the lawsuit cost a bunch of money, and so they ended up as they had some loans, I think. In 1989, when they announced they had found it, they were able to get a loan very quickly for $10 million. And then Christie's came into the picture, and Christie said, well, we'll just assume that loan for you. We'll pay back the bank, and we'll go forward we'll market this, and we'll have a big auction and all of that stuff. And Tommy said, well, that may not be the best way to do it. Let's talk about this. And they talked for years about the best way to distribute the gold. And in the middle of that was all that Christie's and Sotheby's, when they were sued for fraud and collusion. And the guy who was the head of Christie's, who was the guy that Tommy was working with, was the whistleblower on his own organization. And a few people went to prison for that. So Christie's and Sotheby's were both upside down, too, while all this was going on. But then there was the interest owed on that $10 million and other money that Christie's had loaned them. And as time went on, they borrowed some more money, and then the interest accumulated. And so, you know, by 10 years later or so, it's up to $43 million. So when they sold it for $50 million, I have no idea what would have the other seven difference would have been used for. But, you know, when you get into things, anybody who's been around for a little while knows that it's always far more complicated than what it seems like on the surface.
Absolutely.
You just alluded to that. And, I have absolute, you know, people, that silly article that came out in Forbes, the guy that wrote that thing.
I'm looking at it right now. It's called Ship of Fools by Mark Tatch and Miriam Gottfried.
Is that the one in Forbes?
Yep.
Yeah. He called me a couple of times, and he was just so, you know, as a journalist, you try to get the truth.
Sure. That's why I'm asking you.
Yeah, well, he was trying to get me to say that Tommy was unreliable, or that Tommy, you know, probably stole the gold, or probably secreted it somewhere, put it in Swiss bank accounts or whatever. You could tell where he was angling on this thing. It was very lopsided, and I haven't talked to any of the investors since the book came out.
This is an incredible story of a terrible tragedy, an incredible series, really, of discoveries, an eccentric engineer, marine engineer, that loves to learn and goes for it and gets himself in all kinds of difficult life challenges every step of the way. What are the lessons from the public from having written this book? Your insights into the lessons from this venture on all the aspects of it. Even the fact that Tommy Thompson is now very difficult to get a hold of or impossible to get hold of. And that there's still this embittered feeling and unfinished business with what happened. Do you think there's a way to salvage or to restore what happened? Because the venture was an incredible, exciting adventure.
Well, I tell you, I'm a big believer in karma and doing what's right and what goes around comes around and all that kind of stuff. I think, you know, again, the older you get, you see that in every circumstance, just telling the truth is by far the best thing to do, not because you're being a nice person. It goes way beyond that. It just comes back to do good things for you. And I think that the original lawsuits in federal court by these groups, this group of lawyers in New York that represented the insurance companies, should never, ever have taken place. These guys had no right to the gold, and the judge decided the case on the federal trial level within 2 or 3 days, and it was simply finders keepers. You know, it's been 130 years. You made no effort whatsoever to try to discover this. It was found in 8,000 feet of water. It required technology on the cutting edge. There was a huge risk to life and capital, not to mention time and effort and giving up your life. And you did nothing. And so all of this belongs to Tommy Thompson and his group.
Mm-hmm.
And then they appealed it, and I never have understood this decision. A lot of people do not. They study this in law school now. This decision by the, I think it's the Second Circuit, or four, maybe it's the Fourth Circuit, I'm sorry, I don't know, but the one that Norfolk would be in, that would be the appellate court at the federal level, which would be the next level. These lawyers representing the insurance companies. The insurance companies, by the way, existed back in 1857. They claimed that they covered the loss and that they were, the legal term is subrogated to the people who then lost the gold because they paid for the loss. But they had no records. And in subrogation, you have to prove that there was a loss. You have to prove that the loss was covered, that there was an actual policy. And you have to prove that you paid the loss. And they couldn't prove for the last two. And yet they were somehow allowed to, the Fourth Circuit looked at this whole thing and said, well, it's not really abandonment. They never abandoned the gold because, well, they used a term something like, there must be overt abandonment. And no one to this day knows what how can you abandon something overtly? You would just go out and pronounce, I guess, that if anybody happens to find your gold later, you don't want it. And that, of course, is absurd. And I think it was a 2-1 decision. There was a scathing dissent, and it was sent back to the court again. And this went on. It lasted for 10 years in federal court. It cost millions of dollars. And when it was all over with, it went back to the same judge the second time, and it was under the law of salvage. And the law of salvage looks at 6 or 7 factors, which some of which I've just mentioned, like risk to life, risk to capital, difficulty, all of these things, time involved. And then it tries to award something that's fair, so that people, if somebody loses something at sea and you pick it up and bring it and put it back into commerce, then you're going to be aiding commerce. You want to encourage people to do that. Well, when that was over, Tommy's group got about 93% and the insurance companies got 7%. But then there was wrangling over, is that 7% of the gold, or is it 7% of the value of the gold, which made a huge difference. Because if it was of the gold, then Tommy, or the insurance companies could go out and sell all the gold at some artificially low price.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this is gravy to them. And then they would set an artificially low floor for the value of the other 93%. So there was this big haggling over that, and in the middle of that, the judge died.
God, this is a motion picture.
Yeah, no, it is. That went on. But as it turned out, the amount of money that the law firm spent, and this was all just contingency for them, meaning that they, if they didn't recover anything, they didn't get anything. And so this was just going to be a big boondoggle for them. So they, it turned out, though, that they spent so much money prosecuting this thing that they lost. They lost millions of dollars, and the firm imploded, and the lawyers left and quit. And that's what goes around comes around.
Absolutely. How beautiful.
Yeah, they should never, ever have brought that lawsuit. But that I think, this dragged it out for another 10 years. Tommy had to shut down all the scientific operations. He couldn't take any more scientists out there. They wanted to take kids out there. They wanted to wire it up to have teachers in the classroom and people out there on the ship. And they had all kinds of grand plans there that they had already started to implement. But they couldn't do it because of these lawsuits, and other people started suing. Now, the investors, I have to be really honest with you, Kim, which I have been all along, by the way, but I really don't understand why the investors have not received something. I don't understand that either. It doesn't compute with me. But I do know it's been extremely complicated. They've been fighting over 200 lawsuits. Some were just dismissed summarily, but it's been very difficult for that reason. And they have to worry about more people going out to the site and trying to steal stuff off of it. And it's been very difficult.
Did they pull up the ship?
No. They brought up the ship's bell. They found trunks. One of the most beautiful pieces in the whole story is there were two, unlike Titanic, where they faked all of the characters, you know, in the movie and all that stuff. There were newlyweds on the ship, and it went down, and they got her off, and she wasn't going to leave unless he could leave with her in the lifeboat, and he said, "I'll be in the next lifeboat," and of course he knew there wasn't going to be another one. That was the last lifeboat, and so the ship sinks, and he goes down with the ship, except that he was one of very, very few men who was rescued.
Wow.
By some little sailing vessel coming through at 2:00 in the morning.
Wow.
And so they were reunited a week later, and they were a wealthy couple from San Francisco, and entrepreneurs out there during the gold rush. Ansel Easton sold furnishings to the steamships. It would be like the guy taking the eggs up in the Sierra Nevada and selling for $3. Those are the guys that made the money. But they were reunited in this fabulous love story ending. And later, when there were all these artifacts were out in the debris field, in this 10-acre debris field, and they had seen this one trunk. It was a fairly large trunk, and they circled it the first year, and they didn't want to touch it till they could recover it properly. And they developed a method for doing that. So they recovered the trunk, and they brought it back, and they worked with people at Ohio State University in Columbus who were experts on bringing something back out of salt water. It had to be kept at a certain temperature, and you slowly pump fresh water into it, and then you can save what's inside. Well, it turned out to be the Easton's trunk. It was wedding presents. It was her dresses, his shirts. It was that had his initials on the cuffs, and it was and to know their story, because she wrote a journal about it, a lengthy, detailed journal about it, and to know their story and to know that that was their trunk it really makes you just go when you see something like that, it gives, you know, you talk about the shiver and the tingle. That's what it causes.
Wow.
How did I get off on that?
That's okay. Well, it's just one of the marvels of the experience.
Yeah, you asked me about lessons learned.
Yes.
I'll tell you one lesson here. This is something that I've told my daughters, too. One of them had just started a new job, graduated from college last year, and she's about to get a bonus. And she said she wants to pay off her car. And I thought, wow, that is a smart kid. She's always going to have money. She found a cute little used car, and she's paid on it for about 8 months, and now she's going to get this bonus, and she said, I'm just going to pay that off. And I said, well, I think that's really smart. I love that you are going to do that. But I said, you know, take a little bit of that and enjoy it. Have fun with it. Buy yourself something really outrageous, you know. Take friends out for a big celebration or something. But it isn't any good unless you learn also to enjoy it. So save a bunch, but also enjoy it. And this is the part, and I've said this publicly before, this is the one thing I fault Tommy for, is that I coach soccer and I coach basketball. My daughters were growing up, and there was always, you know, so many people out there, your listeners can identify with this, there was always the team dinner at the end of the year, and the coach gets up and says nice things about each of the kids, and they get their trophy or a sweatshirt or whatever. That never happened here. There should have been a huge banquet with all the investors who put the money up at risk and believed in Tommy. And then you had John Moore, and you had Alan Scott and Bob Evans and Barry Schatz and John Doring and Milt Butterworth Todd and Brian, the two guys, Brian Anderson and Todd Steele, who were the deckhands. All these guys, I'm sure I missed somebody in there somewhere, and I apologize, but all of these guys literally risked their lives, came very close time and time again. Bill Burlingham, the captain of the ship that they used to launch their technology from. All these guys risked their lives, and there needed to be some kind of public recognition of that. And I doubt if there would have been one investor who would have objected if Tommy had taken just one gold coin and given it to each of those guys.
Absolutely. It's the proper way to have proceeded.
You have to enjoy. You have to take time to sit back.
Actually, everyone who was on that ship, if it were my ship, would have had a piece of the action for making it happen. And I would have insisted with the investors up front that if we find X, that everybody here who's risking their lives, etc., will have a certain percentage and agreed on that percentage so that that could happen immediately upon bringing it up.
Well, I'm involved in a venture myself right now as the entrepreneur in some software I've created for writing, I want to put together a team where everybody's invested in it. It really is a team. I can't do this by myself, and I want to get the very best people. But a part of them being the best is that they have to be fun people to work with, and they have to be enthusiastic, and honest and all of those things. And we're going to have a good time. We're going to have a good time doing this, and we're going to do something that nobody's ever done before. And it's going to be really fun and exciting. But you want everybody to share in that. It really, this whole idea of being part of a team is just immensely gratifying.
Whatever happened to Donald Glauer, who was Tommy Thompson's mentor? What did Donald Glauer ever say after this whole thing took place?
You know, I don't know. I have not talked to him. He was the dean of the College of Engineering at Ohio State, where Tommy was in school. And I talked to him, interviewed him when I was researching the book, but I don't know. I haven't talked to him. I don't know what he was doing or has been doing since. I know he was probably quite proud because he's the one who said, you know, this is tough. I know what is. He, as it turned out, was a marine engineer himself. And that's why when it turns out this one kid out of 8,000 engineering students wants to be a marine engineer, that's why he became Tommy's sort of advisor and then mentor. But he told these the original investors at a luncheon one day, he said, I don't know if Tommy can find this, but I do know that if anybody can find it, he likely is the one, because he had made cuts. Quite a wide swath in engineering school, not because of his grades, but because he didn't care what his grades were. He was really impressing a lot of people along the way because the way he thought, he thought in a whole different way. I don't even want to use the common term that includes the word box. He was way beyond that.
Yeah, it's a different paradigm.
Whole different level. And he told these guys, he said, I do know this, that these potential investors, I do know this. It's going to happen. Now, when it happens, I don't know. It might be 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now, but we are developing technology. We are going to go to the bottom of the deep ocean, and Tommy would be a pretty good bet.
So didn't they go 8,000 feet below sea level? They didn't even have the technology. I mean, maybe our military has that technology, but civilian life didn't have that technology.
Well, you know, this is the difference. I had a hard time with this at the very beginning, understanding all of this, because as a writer, you don't want to go out there saying something and have other people say, are you crazy? That never happened, or that's not true. We've been doing this for 20 years. And I kept reading articles about the Alvin and the Turtle and all of these big government projects. And one day I was... one of the engineers involved in this was, he literally wrote the book on underwater tools. If you wanted to work in the ocean at any depth, you went to Don Hackman at Patel Memorial Institute, a big campus of 3,000 engineers and scientists in Columbus. And I was talking to him one day, and we were talking about... you know, what it would take to work in the deep ocean, and he was saying even then, you know, you can't some of these things you just can't do, and he would lay out all the problems for me, and I called him one day because I was reading this book, and it said, well, the Turtle was designed to go to down at depths of 10,000 feet and recover large pieces and small pieces delicately and all this stuff. And so I called Don Hackman, and I read this to him, and I said, Don, they're saying this was happening back in the 60s and 70s. And he said, read that to me again. And I said, well, the Turtle was designed, and he said, stop right there. He said, it was designed to do that. It never worked. And he said, they brought it to me. They brought this manipulator. They were trying to get to work in the deep water. They brought it to me to see if I could fix it, and I couldn't do it either. But it didn't work. And the difference was the Alvin had been around since, in 64, I think. And you could go down in the Alvin, and you could look. And eventually they had a really crude little manipulator that could grasp something big and rough and bring it, you know, a pipe or something, and bring it back, you know, hang on to it and bring it back to the surface. But the difference that Don Glauer, the dean, put in Tommy's head, he said, how are we going to learn to work in the bottom of the deep ocean? Go to the bottom of the deep ocean had been done, but how are we going to work down there? And that was Tommy's challenge, and that's what he overcame. And the federal government could not do that. And to this day, I don't follow this anymore, but to this day, I doubt if they can do it.
Well, I hope Tommy Thompson resurfaces and really goes for the next challenge.
Yeah.
Because somebody who went through all that, no matter what happened, should be focused on solving all kinds of challenges and problems that we have and developing new technologies. I hope that something is at work in him, wherever he is, to do that.
Well, I'm just sure that, you know, his mind did not quit before the lawsuit started. You know, he has been fighting these lawsuits, and he's been spending a lot of time, you know, in lawsuits and working with the lawyers and all that. But I'm sure he's been working on other things, too, and we're going to hear from him again.
I hope so.
He doesn't want to talk to reporters. He doesn't want to talk to other people. If they want to think that he's on the lam and hiding and you know, and Prague or something, that's fine with him. He doesn't care.
Well, if you ever talk to him again, will you tell Tommy Thompson that Kim Greenhouse wants to invite him to It's Rainmaking Time to hear from him personally? And we would like to hear about the ship of gold that's in his head that has him coming up with all these technologies and solving all these problems and finding this ship. And I want to thank you for an incredible job you did writing the national bestseller, Ship of Gold in the Deep Blue Sea. Ladies and gentlemen, you can reach Gary Kinder at GaryKinder.com. And is there any other site that you have, Gary, that you'd like people to check into?
I didn't know I even had that one, to tell you the truth. I've never checked it. I don't know what that is.
What's your site?
It's under, my day job is teaching lawyers. I have a law degree, although I don't practice, but I teach lawyers how to improve their writing for over 20 years now. But that's kinderlegal.com.
Okay, well, you can reach Gary at kinderlegal.com and also at garykinder.com. I'm looking at the site right now, and you can buy the book, Ship of Gold, and you really should buy Ship of Gold in the Deep Blue Sea by Gary Kinder. Gary, I want to thank you for being with us today at It's Rainmaking Time. I hope that you will come back because there's so many facets to this adventure.
Yes, yes, there are, Kim. Thank you very much. It's nice talking with you.
Pleasure. Thank you so much, Gary.